Penguin Random House Audio presents An Impossible Imposter by Deanna Raban. Read for you by Angèle Meusters. For Danielle and Pam. Chapter 1. Somewhere between Paris and London, April 1889. I do not care for infants, and even if I did, I should not care for this one. It is decidedly moist, I protested to Stoker, thrusting the child towards him. He took it with good grace, and it emitted a sort of cooing sound. It seems to like you, I observed. I could not find fault with the child on that score. From his thirst for adventure to his avid intelligence, Stoker was an eminently likable man when he was in good spirits. The fact that he was superbly fit and partial to reciting Keats in moments of tenderness entered into my assessment of him not in the slightest. I am, after all, a woman of science. Stoker dandled the infant on his knee, and it regarded him solemnly, eyes wide and round. I use the word infant in its loosest interpretation. It had, in fact, been born some 9 or 10 months before, and possessed the appropriate number of teeth and skills for a child of that age. If we had permitted, it would have roamed the first-class compartment where we were comfortably ensconced en route from Paris to London. The fact that the journey included a channel crossing via boat train was one of a dozen considerations in bringing along the child's nurse, a stout matron of something more than 40 years. She was a calmly capable woman who managed her charge with a combination of ruthless efficiency and dollops of real affection. I had taken the precaution of purchasing leather leads to attach to the infant to prevent it from getting loose, but Madame Laborde assured me she was entirely capable of running it to ground should it escape. Escape seemed the last thing on its mind as it wound its chubby fist around Stoker's index finger. As usual, the digit in question was stained with ink and smelt of honey and tobacco, thanks to Stoker's inveterate habits. We had been in the child's company for only a few hours, but it had already ascertained that Stoker's pockets were a veritable hoard of sweets. It put out an imperious hand, and Stoker shook his head.
You have had two already, and you must eat your luncheon first.
The small person, I relate without exaggeration, narrowed its eyes and drew in a slow, deep breath. Then it opened its little maw and bellowed like a tiny bull. Hastily, Stoker thrust a hand into his pocket, rootling about until he extracted a paper twist of honey drops. He plopped one into the child's mouth, just as it prepared to roar again. Instantly, the rosebud lips clamped shut and curved into a smile. It emitted another coo, and the nurse sighed.
Monsieur, she said evenly, you must not spoil the child. He is headstrong enough without being indulged.
She related this in French, as her English was poor, and Stoker shrugged, pantomiming that he did not understand the language. This was a patent falsehood. I had discovered him on numerous occasions reading saucy French novels in the original tongue. He claimed it made them more romantique. I smiled at the nurse. Madame, I told her in her native language, you must excuse Monsieur. He lacks your fine Gallic common sense. He is half Irish, and they are a sentimental race. Stoker opened his mouth and snapped it shut again without speaking. Officially, he was the third son of the late Viscount Templeton Vane. Unofficially, he was the result of a passionate liaison between the Viscountess and the portraitist who had come from Galway to paint her in oils. Stoker did not generally enjoy discussing his parentage, but he could not now object unless he admitted to understanding French, and it was a situation I decided to exploit to the fullest. He is the same with his dogs, I went on. He lets them sleep in his bed, and he feeds them from his own plate. She shuddered. The French, I have observed, are devoted to their pets, but even they have limits. With a great deal of concentration, the infant took the sweet from its mouth and held it up to the light in one chubby fist, like a jeweler studying the facets of a rare gem. Then it popped the treasure back onto its tongue and began to pat Stoker's cheeks with its filthy hands. Suddenly, a noxious aroma filled the compartment. The cherub was sitting with a beatific expression on its face, as if it were not the author of the atrocity, but I knew better. I opened the window and gave the nurse a pointed look. Madame Laborde hoisted herself to her feet and put out her hands for her charge. "Avec moi, mon trésor, s'il vous plaît," she said briskly. She rattled off something about attending to the child's condition and took her leave with the creature. Stoker unearthed one of his enormous scarlet pocket handkerchiefs and began to scrub at the sticky marks on his chin. "You are a natural with children," I said mildly. "I did not realize you had much experience with them."
"Oh, yes, in the travelling show."
Stoker had run away from his aristocratic home at the age of 12 and attached himself to a sort of circus, working his way up from amateur conjurer to knife thrower and prize fighter.
"Violet, the human sow,"
he told me with a fond smile of reminiscence.
"She was a lovely woman, gave birth every year, usually to twins or triplets. The proprietor made her wear a pink singlet and a velvet snout to cuddle a few infant pigs while the rest of us carried her actual babies about."
"That is appalling," I said, preparing to launch into a righteous tirade about reducing women to their breeding capabilities, but Stoker forestalled me.
"Not as appalling as that smell,"
he replied, pinching his nose. "Blame your small and unhygienic friend," I instructed. He shook his head.
"No, that odour was blown away with the fresh air," he said, nodding towards the open window. "The stench that remains is courtesy of your travelling companion."
He fixed an eye upon the enormous item sitting next to me. It was a wheel of cheese, just short of 100 weight, its rind washed in the sweet wine of the Alpenwald, a Middle European country that had proven the setting for the conclusion of our last adventure. We had performed a service for the princess of that country at great peril to our own lives and limbs, and in return the lady had invited us to her wedding. It had been a bittersweet time. The princess, poor soul, had married for the security of her throne rather than the dictates of her heart, but we had enjoyed the many courtesies extended to us. We had been away more than a fortnight and had fallen woefully behind in our work for the Earl of Rosmoren. We had been engaged at his lordship's Marylebone estate to catalogue the collection amassed by his ancestors in preparation for the creation of a museum designed to educate and entertain the masses. Housed in the Belvedere, a sort of freestanding ballroom of enormous proportions on his lordship's property, the collection was as varied as it was vast. Egyptian mummies jostled medieval suits of armour, while caryatids looked down their aristocratic noses at the confusion. The bulk of the collection was devoted to natural history, animals stuffed and mounted from the furthest reaches of the globe, and most in a state of mouldering decay. The restoration of such mounts was Stoker's speciality, whilst mine was the preservation of the butterflies and moths. A lepidopterist by trade, accustomed to voyaging the world in search of specimens to sell, I had taken the position with the Earl on the understanding that it would entail a certain amount of travel. Instead, I found myself most days tucked into some cobwebby corner of the Belvedere, plucking out desiccated butterflies and inking labels. It was not entirely the Earl's fault. He had vastly underestimated the time required to make the collection fit for exhibition, and my own activities had frequently interrupted the work. Stoker and I had developed the habit of murder, the solving of, I hasten to add, not the commission of, although the Earl's numerous and exuberant children might have tempted me to try. Their mother long dead, the children ran wild, despite the best efforts of the Earl and his sister, Lady Cordelia. The lady and I had become fast friends, regardless of the differences in rank and experience, and I had been deeply honoured that she had chosen me as her companion when she sojourned half a year in Madeira. I had anticipated long days spent with my butterfly net, pursuing the enchanting black-and-white spotted Hippolymnus missippus, but instead I found myself trotting out on endless errands, fetching remedies for morning sickness and swollen feet, as the reason for Lady C's abrupt withdrawal from public life made itself apparent. I held her hand through the worst of it, but there are scenes indelibly printed upon my memory, scenes of such barnyard specificity that no childless woman should be forced to witness them. But Lady C had delighted in her bovine contentment, so much that she altered her plans to have the babe adopted out. Instead, she arranged for a temporary situation until the child was fully weaned and could travel safely in the company of the French nurse she had engaged to care for it. The infant had been in Paris for some weeks, and Lady C wrote to me in the Alpenwald, requesting that I retrieve it for her, much as one would ask a friend to collect a piece of left luggage from a train station. She cleverly reasoned that, as the child had come from Paris, no one would connect it with her journey to Madeira. Presented as a French foundling, it could be adopted by her and raised as her own child, although without benefit of her name. The situation was not ideal, but it was far better than any alternative. I had little use for society and its various hypocrisies, but Lady C was deeply conscious of her brother's honour, and the fact that her beloved nieces and nephews would be tarred with the same brush used to blacken her name, should the truth come out. And so, Stoker and I had stopped in Paris for a few days to enjoy the spring sunshine, pay a lengthy visit to Desrolles, the taxidermical emporium where Stoker wandered in a state of considerable rapture, marvel at the hypnotic ugliness of the newly constructed tower by Monsieur Eiffel, and collect the child. It came with an abundance of things, rubber berths and travelling cots and tiny chairs and far more clothes than I owned. I gathered from a conversation with Madame Laborde that Lady C had been lavish in sending presents. But all the infant's impedimenta could not rival my own souvenir of the Alpenwald, the cheese. I had purchased it as a gift for the Earl in recognition of his many kindnesses and inexhaustible patience with our detectable endeavours. I could never be persuaded from the course of justice, and as a result, Stoker and I were forever haring off on some adventure or other. If we were not chasing a resurrected Egyptian god down a sewer or ballooning past Big Ben, we were being variously shot at, stabbed, abducted, or drowned. A nice wheel of cheese seemed a small price to pay for the Earl overlooking our frequent absences. Unfortunately, I had underestimated the most notable of the Alpenwalder cheese's qualities. It was renowned amongst gourmets for its aroma, earthy, with the slightest suggestion of goat. In short, it stank, and the longer one carried it about, through overheated train compartments and warm spring sunshine, the more pungent it became. By the time we reached Calais, the odour of the cheese had taken on a sort of personality, a fifth traveller in our merry band, ensuring that wherever we went, porters ignored us and crowds parted. Stoker had been forced to carry it himself, his clothing now permanently imbued with the stink of it. He eyed me reproachfully, but I pretended not to notice. We arrived back in London on a gloomy morning. A chill fog rolled off the River Thames, blanketing the city and muffling traffic. The odoriferous cheese announced our presence, and before a hapless porter could make his escape, I cornered him and forced him to help us shift our baggage to the carriage Lady C had sent. We clip-clopped through streets shrouded in mist, and by the time we arrived at Bishop's Folly, the estate in Marylebone, we were damp and cold to the bone. Usually our comings and goings were of little note, but this time the entire Beauclerc family turned out to greet us. Lady C took charge of her child and the Earl of his cheese, and the children of the quantity of Swiss chocolate Stoker had purchased for them. Our bags were sent to our lodgings, two of the follies built by previous earls to cluster picturesquely around a pond. Stoker's was a pagoda, while I had chosen to lodge in a Gothic structure reminiscent of Saint-Chapelle, lavish with pointed arches and stained glass. But at his lordship's urging, we made straight for the Belvedere itself, our place of work and refreshment.
"I have a new acquisition, and it has only just arrived," Lord Rosmorin announced, rubbing his hands together.
Stoker flinched, and I gave the Earl a look of frank alarm. His enthusiasm was matched only by his fortune, and both were often in service of things only an eccentric nobleman could love. As soon as word of his intended museum spread, his aristocratic friends had taken the opportunity to clear out their own attics and country houses, sending along cartfuls of appalling things. Sorting through the detritus of some of England's finest families would have been enough to turn my hair white had I not been made of stern stuff. So I had, tactfully but firmly, insisted that his lordship promise to discuss future additions to the collection with us, his curators. Catching sight of my expression, he hurried to explain.
"Naturally, I would have conferred with the two of you, but you were in the Alpenwald, and I had to act quickly, you see. Reggie Anstruther offered me a good deal, but only if I agreed to the whole lot, and only if I took delivery immediately."
Stoker's sigh was profound, but his lordship's excitement was undiminished. He threw open the door of the Belvedere and stopped short. Packed almost to the entrance itself was a stack of crates, row after row, and enormous rolls of fabric, painted canvas that had been furled like sails.
"What precisely are we looking at?"
Stoker asked politely. The Earl seized a pry bar and began to open the crates.
"The entire collection from the French Opera Theatre Reggie owned. A fine fellow of business, Reggie," he said absently as he tossed aside the first lid.
From Lord Anstruther's reputation, I would have said it was safe to conclude he was not, in fact, a fine fellow of business. Every month was a new scheme, usually something calculated to provide access to comely young women of some talent and flexible morals. He was forever investing in dramatic companies and ballet troupes.
"Lord Anstruther has got out of the theatrical business, then?" I inquired.
The first crate appeared to be full of costumes, and the Earl was busy inspecting his new treasures.
"What was that? Oh, yes, at least no more opera. He says singers are devilishly temperamental. The last one threw a shoe at his head and nearly took out his eye. So he's sold off the opera theatre and used the money to invest in a troupe of girls who do tricks on horseback. It's very popular, he says. He means to take them on a tour of the provinces. Look here," he called, diving into the crate.
He emerged wearing a brown velvet donkey's head. It was sporting a wreath of flowers and a ridiculous grin.
"Hello, I am Bottom," he proclaimed happily.
"From the Fairy Queen,"
Stoker agreed, holding up a programme. A stack of them had been stuffed beneath the ass's head, and he thumbed through them.
"Odd to think of a French company performing Purcell, but then it seems they were quite Catholic in their tastes. Some Mozart, Berlioz's Les Troyens, Massenet's Le Roi de Laure, even Beethoven.
He began to hum tunefully from Fidelio, and I turned to the Earl, who was struggling to remove the donkey's head. "Let me help you," I urged.
"Most kind,"
he said, as I tugged at the velvet ears. It took a good deal of yanking, the donkey's head proving as stubborn as the animal itself, but at last the Earl emerged, red-faced and a little sweaty.
"Jolly good fun. Must put that aside for the children," he said. "They might like to put on an amateur dramatical for Midsummer."
I was not a little relieved to hear that his lordship intended at least some of the collection to find its way to the dressing-up box. Stoker had opened another crate and was half drowned in a sea of silks and velvets. The peplos of Trojans, the embroidered robes of Asian kings, and an enormous panniered gown of spangled purple that could only have belonged to a queen of the night.
"But why,"
he asked the Earl,
"did you buy all of this if you only meant to give it to the children?"
Lord Rosmoren rummaged through the crates until he found the one he wanted.
"Ah, this is why,"
he said, prying it open. Nestled in a heap of excelsior was a tangle of brown wooden limbs and heavy silk strings.
"The marionettes,"
he explained, lifting one out. It was a harlequin, dressed in the distinctive multicoloured diamond pattern, an enormous feathery pom-pom attached to its hat.
"They are from Sicily, made by the Castrovinci family in the 17th century. Look here, a Tancred!"
He plunged his hand into the excelsior and emerged with a puppet dressed in a suit of armour, the visor of his helmet thrown back to reveal a lavish set of black moustaches.
"Ready to ride off on crusade. You know, the Sicilian puppet theatre."
What followed was nearly an hour of discussion on the history of the Sicilian puppetry tradition. I like to think it would have been diverting had I not been fatigued from the channel crossing, but in fact, it would not. There was far too much explanation on the intricacies of choosing the correct type of olive tree for a marionette, and I reflected, as his lordship's gentle monologue continued to burble on, that no one should ever know quite so much about puppets. At last, his lordship, reminded of the delicacy of the awaiting Alpenwalder cheese, wound down and left us amidst the litter of crates and excelsior. The canvas sails proved to be painted backdrops used to set the scene for the opera company, and the other boxes were packed full of furniture, props, costumes and wigs. I made a few choice selections to hold back from the children's dressing-up box, and Stoker scrutinised them.
"Why are you keeping those?"
he inquired. "Disguises," I explained. "We may not intentionally seek out adventures, but they seem to seek us, and it is best to be prepared." He lifted one garment between his fingertips.
"This is a scarlet cassock, Veronica. Exactly when do you plan on disguising yourself as a cardinal?"
"One never knows," I replied loftily. I tossed it into a crate with the other items I meant to keep and dusted my hands. "And now, food," I said with a decisive gesture. Upstairs in the Belvedere was a sort of snuggery, fitted with a Swedish stove, Napoleon's campaign bed, and an assortment of cushions for the various dogs we had collected. Bettany, the Earl's Caucasian sheepdog, Newt, an Egyptian hound of Stoker's, Huxley, his bulldog, and my own noble Vespertine, a deerhound of great distinction. We took luncheon with them and later tea, spending the afternoon in a haze of cosy domestic bliss, as we read through our correspondence, skimmed newspapers, and crumbled scones for the dogs. I glanced up to find Stoker deep in concentration as he read an editorial regarding the subject of votes for women. He supported the notion, and something thudded in my chest. At the time, I put it down to indigestion, The Earl's cook was an accomplished woman, but occasionally her rock cakes were frankly indigestible. Only later did I wonder if it might have been a premonition. For that afternoon was the last truly uncomplicated moment of happiness I was to know for a long time. Chapter 2. The summons came the next day. A brief note from Sir Hugo Montgomery, the head of Special Branch of Scotland Yard, delivered just after Stoker and I had settled to breakfast in the Belvedere. Stoker helped himself to a dish of eggs, arranged as usual on the sarcophagus we used as a sideboard, whilst I munched contentedly through a stack of buttered toast and read the newspapers, eager to see what I had missed during our travels abroad. A more serious soul might have reached first for the Times, but I have never claimed that particular virtue. I happily unfurled the latest edition of the Daily Harbinger, an illustrated periodical given to ludicrous flights of fancy, complete with pictures of the most lurid variety. Stoker deplored my taste in newspapers, but I had found the Daily Harbinger to be highly instructive upon occasion. The fact that the pieces were only accidentally and intermittently based in truth did not alter my enjoyment. I had discovered the stories within were best taken with a hefty pinch of salt. But one thing I marked was the absence of any mention of the fiend whose reign of terror had dominated the headlines the previous autumn. After his orgy of killing early in November, it appeared the Ripper had slipped once more into the hell-bound shadows whence he had come, and London seemed to breathe a little easier as the spring commenced. Not that the city was without its tensions. Parliament was sitting, and, unsurprisingly, the question of independence was on everyone's lips. "Unrest in the Empire," screamed the Harbinger.
"Whose independence?"
Stoker asked in reply to my remark upon the subject. I began ticking off the groups on my fingers. Women? The suffragists staged a rally in Green Park, shouting loudly enough to be heard inside Buckingham Palace, although the Queen was not in attendance. The Irish, predictably. There have been a spate of demonstrations in Dublin in favour of Home Rule. The Brazilians are thoroughly at odds with their Emperor. And now the Indians. Apparently the notion of self-rule has gained popularity there as well. Members of the Commons intend to introduce bills to debate the idea of self-government for both countries, although not the vote for women, I added darkly.
The Queen won't much care for talk of India breaking free of the Empire,
he mused.
Rip says she quite likes calling herself Empress.
Stoker's second brother, Sir Rupert, Rip to his family, had been knighted for services to the crown. Officially, the accolade had come for translating Chinese poetry, but Sir Rupert had confided one night after a third glass of whisky that it had actually been conferred for diplomatic work of the most discreet variety. Her Majesty was seldom seen in public, having withdrawn to Windsor Castle after the death of her beloved consort, but Sir Rupert still saw her occasionally, enough to note the creamy, cat-like expression of satisfaction she wore whenever the subject of her Indian title arose in conversation. He was loyal to a fault, but upon this particular occasion he had performed a marvellous impression of her, complete with a napkin draped over his head and an upended pudding dish in place of her tiny crown. I pulled a face. She mightn't have much choice. There was a bombing at a government office in Lucknow. Stoker shied like a pony.
Anarchists?
We had had more than our share of trouble with such people, and I shared his reluctance to encounter more of them. In our experience, anarchists might claim to have the good of the people at heart, but they were often quite untidy in their methods. One of the extremist groups, I said, skimming the lines. But a more moderate delegation has come to London for a series of meetings. They hope to achieve their means by peaceful negotiation. There was a photograph of the leader of the delegation, a Maharani of mature years, which I applauded. It was far beyond the time when women should take their seat at the table of international politics, I believed. Unlike their masculine counterparts, women were far less likely to fling themselves headlong into war to begin with. I was about to hold forth on the subject when George, the hall boy, appeared, waving a letter that had just arrived in the second post. I slit it open with a fruit knife and skimmed the lines, noticing they had been penned in haste. Sir Hugo's handwriting, while always spidery, did not usually lurch quite so alarmingly. "Sir Hugo asks us to meet him in Hyde Park," I said, "near the Serpentine." Stoker broke a sausage to pieces and fed the bits to the dogs.
"Absolutely not."
I blinked at him. "Stoker, we cannot refuse. The Metropolitan Police Force is the finest in the world," I said stoutly, "and Special Branch is its most illustrious division."
"Feathers,"
he said, piling more eggs onto his plate and adding a few deviled kidneys for good measure. "And," I went on, as if he had not interrupted, "Sir Hugo is the head of Special Branch. That makes him one of the foremost champions of law and order anywhere on the globe." He sat heavily and plunged his fork into the heap of food on his plate, fixing me with a dark look.
"I refuse."
"You have no reason to refuse," I said evenly. Stoker, being a male of the species, could not help occasionally erupting into irrationality. I had long observed that when a man does so, it is simplest to treat him with the same calm good humour one might employ when coaxing a stubborn horse or a slightly backwards child. He put down his fork.
"I can give you a score of reasons. I have been shot, I have been stabbed, I have been abducted, I have been very nearly drowned."
I held up a hand. "For which you can hardly blame Sir Hugo. He did not drown you, nor did he abduct you. He has never shot you, and I am the only person who has stabbed you. It is illogical in the extreme to blame poor Sir Hugo for any of those inconveniences."
"Inconveniences?"
His voice rose an octave.
"You do recall that I very nearly died during one or two of those events?"
"Lower your voice, my love. You are alarming the dogs." I nodded to where the pack had pricked up their ears. He picked up his fork again and stabbed a piece of bacon.
"I know what this is about. You are feeling restless again. It has been 2 months since we last encountered a corpse, and you nurture hopes that Sir Hugo will put us on the scent of fresh adventure."
He waved his fork for emphasis. "Do not point your breakfast meats at me, sir," I said, in a tone of mild reproach. "I will admit only to a curiosity about what Sir Hugo wants, and a willingness to put my talents, whatever they may be, at his disposal. For the good of England," I finished.
"For your own bloody amusement,"
he muttered, stuffing the bacon into his mouth.
"Besides, I have a new mount to disassemble today. Lord Rosemarin spent hours playing with those benighted puppets, and never even mentioned he has just taken delivery of a rather nice albino giraffe from the Duke of Grasmere's collection. It's in filthy condition, and apparently I am the only man in England His Grace trusts to repair it."
He preened a little as he helped himself to more bacon. I widened my eyes. "Heavens! How long has it been dead?" He shrugged.
60 or 70 odd years.
"Then it will still be dead when you return," I said, smiling. He growled and grimaced all the way through breakfast, but in the end he put on his coat and came with me. Although, as a token of his annoyance, he made no move to pay for the hansom cab. Sir Hugo had instructed us to our rendezvous, and I took care that we should arrive a few minutes before the appointed time. Sir Hugo could be as prickly as Stoker when vexed, and I hoped to find him in good humour. It had occurred to me to wonder if Sir Hugo had finally learnt of our Alpenwalder escapade. The events of that investigation had caused me to impersonate the princess of that country, a small crime, I supposed, and commit one or two other, much more significant acts. One might even be considered treason by an ungenerous person, I reflected. Sir Hugo, knowing the secret of my semi-royal birth, had been accommodating upon occasion, but I did not know if his indulgence would extend to criminal conspiracies, particularly those involving diplomatic relations. It seemed wisest not to test him if such a situation might be avoided. And so it was a quarter of an hour before the designated time when Stoker and I passed through the gates of Hyde Park, where the plane trees were unfurling their soft green leaves to greet the spring with good cheer. Around the Serpentine, nannies pushed their charges in perambulators, both carefully polished. We passed a Sikh gentleman in a turban, quietly feeding breadcrumbs to the ducks, and a woman of insalubrious appearance having a lengthy conversation with a red squirrel, whose ears twitched in response. I might have deplored the bustle and grime of the city, but London was also endlessly diverting, I reflected. I had dressed in a town suit of heavy violet silk, the cut neat and just fashionable enough not to attract much attention. But venturing out with Stoker was rather like taking a pet lynx for a walk. He, too, wore a town suit, of excellent make, the aristocratic habit of good tailoring being one he could not bring himself to abandon. A closer look revealed the odd stain of wax or ink or custard cream, due to his inveterate habit of wiping his fingers upon the nearest piece of cloth. But even if his suit had been in a state of pristine tidiness, he would have arrested attention. He was tall, reaching just 6 feet, and broadly muscled, his shoulders straining the seams of his coat. His hair, thick and black, waved to the bottom of his collar. His shirt concealed the myriad tattoos he had received whilst in Her Majesty's Navy, but the slim silver scar that ran from one brow to the cheekbone was silent witness to his encounter with a jaguar in the Amazonian jungles. That his eye had not been lost was a miracle, but the injury had left him subject to fatigue, and when that happened he wore an eye patch, black as a pirate's heart. Coupled with the hooped gold earrings in his ears, the eye patch presented a creditable impression of a buccaneer, and I was not surprised when one or two nannies hurried their charges out of his path. I was even less surprised to see the expression of frank longing on the faces of a few of the maids. He is, without question, a striking-looking man. To my surprise, Sir Hugo had already arrived and was sitting on a bench, well wrapped against the late morning chill. He rose as we approached and touched his hat.
"Miss Speedwell," he said,
inclining his head in a courtly gesture.
"Templeton Vane."
As the third son of the late Viscount of that name, Stoker was an honourable, and his given name was Revelstoke, neither of which he enjoyed. For as long as I had known him, he was Stoker to friend and foe alike. He gave Sir Hugo a cool nod in return.
"It is rather too brisk for sitting,"
Sir Hugo said.
"Why don't we walk, and I will tell you why I have summoned you."
It was not a question. He put a hand under my elbow and propelled me forward. Stoker joined us on my other side, and we moved onto a quiet path away from the nannies and their charges. "We would have been happy to come to you at Scotland Yard," I began. Sir Hugo held up a hand.
"No, this is a private matter, not police business,"
he said. He paused a moment.
"I should like to ask you for a favour, of a personal nature."
Stoker's brows shot skywards, but he said nothing. "Go on," I urged. We began to walk again, slowly, as Sir Hugo spoke.
It concerns my goddaughter, Euphemia. Or rather, it concerns her entire family. They are called Hathaway, and they live at Hathaway Hall on Dartmoor. Miss Speedwell, are you quite all right? I think you stumbled there.
A pebble in my shoe, I assured him. No matter, do go on.
Well, I am a little vexed about the question of Euphemia, he said.
And what is the trouble with Euphemia? I asked, in a deliberately casual tone. Unsuitable suitor? Gambling debts? Sir Hugo pressed his lips together.
Euphemia is entirely above reproach, he said stiffly. The whole family are guided by principles of service and duty, but they have known their share of tragedy. Let me begin with her grandparents, Lady Hathaway, Ada, and Sir Geoffrey, knighted for his service in India. Sir Geoffrey died last year, but Ada still lives at Hathaway Hall, although I understand her health is poor these days. She is very much in decline, I'm afraid. Who else lives at the Hall?
Stoker inquired.
Euphemia's parents? No, they died in India some 15 years ago. Euphemia was a small child. She scarcely remembers them. Her official guardian was her grandfather, Sir Geoffrey, but since his death last year, the Hall and its responsibilities have fallen to her elder brother, Charles. He, too, was in India, but he came to England upon inheriting the Hall. He has established himself there with his wife and young children, and they comprise the household along with the servants and Ada's companion.
He paused, giving me a quick sideways glance.
Euphemia wrote to me recently, a most extraordinary letter. You see, Charles was actually the second-born son by some years. The eldest, Jonathan, was the heir to Hathaway Hall.
I stumbled again, but Sir Hugo's tight grip on my elbow saved me. I turned to face him. Jonathan? Jonathan Hathaway, I said in a hollow voice. But that's extraordinary. I know him, or at least I did. My voice trailed off. Sir Hugo's eyes were mournful.
Yes, I am afraid you did.
Stoker looked from one of us to the other.
What happened to Jonathan Hathaway?
I was silent a long moment, thinking of the kindly young man I had known. He died, I said finally, in the eruption of Krakatoa. Stoker took my hand in his. I did not often speak of the eruption. It had been a cataclysm that haunted me still. The very earth itself seemed to crack in two, heaving the world into chaos. Jonathan and I had been members of the same party travelling together when warnings had come that it was too dangerous to venture nearer the Sunda Strait, where the volcano was waking. I had heeded the caution of the local people, remaining at my lodgings in Sumatra. But Jonathan, with his cheerful certainty that all would be well, had gone ahead with another of our travelling companions. Neither had been heard from again.
Of course, Jonathan's loss was devastating for the family,
Sir Hugo went on.
His grandfather never quite recovered from the blow, and that is when Ada, Lady Hathaway's, health began to fail. Sir Geoffrey, dispirited, nonetheless understood that Charles was now his heir. The estate was not entailed, so the fact that Jonathan's body was not recovered at the time did not impede the settling of the inheritance. Sir Geoffrey drew up a new will, leaving Hathaway Hall and the guardianship of Euphemia to her brother Charles. As I said, last year Sir Geoffrey died, and Charles came from India to take charge of matters. It was all handled as efficiently and as properly as possible, he said. Then what is the trouble?
Stoker asked. Sir Hugo drew in a deep breath.
The trouble is that after 6 years, Jonathan Hathaway has come home.
Chapter 3. That is quite impossible, I said flatly. He died in the eruption.
How was it that his body was never recovered?
Stoker asked. It was pandemonium, I told him. Utter chaos for months afterwards.
Did you remain in Sumatra?
Sir Hugo asked. Yes, I said sharply. My friends were missing. I stayed for some weeks, until it became apparent there was no point in entertaining hopes. They were lost.
And yet, Jonathan Hathaway survived,
Sir Hugo said gently.
But how?
Stoker asked. Sir Hugo's brow furrowed.
I do not know the particulars, only that a man has appeared at Hathaway Hall and Lady Hathaway has recognized him as her grandson.
I was quick to spot the discrepancy. Only Lady Hathaway, not the rest of the family?
The rest of the family did not know Jonathan well,
he said thoughtfully.
As the heir, he was sent to England as a boy for his education. He stayed with Sir Geoffrey and Lady Hathaway at the Hall during school holidays, whilst the younger children remained in India. Charles and Effie came to England later. Only Lady Hathaway is left of the family who knew Jonathan as a grown man. There must be servants,
Stoker said.
A nanny? A gardener? Someone?
Sir Hugo shrugged.
Her ladyship closed up much of the house after Sir Geoffrey's death. It is an expensive place to run, and she wished to economize. The family that had been in service the longest took the opportunity to emigrate. That was the gardener, the cook, and their housemaid daughters gone in one fell swoop. The housekeeper is still there, but she is a cautious woman. The house has since been opened up, with Charles Hathaway coming to live there with his family, but the staff are almost entirely new, I understand. Charles Hathaway and his wife would not thank the housekeeper for recognizing Jonathan Hathaway,
Stoker mused.
That would certainly upset the apple cart. It would indeed,
Sir Hugo agreed.
The estate has come to Charles quite legally, and Jonathan, if it is indeed Jonathan, would have to challenge their grandfather's will in court. That would be an expensive proposition, and I doubt he has the means to do it. But it would still sow enormous discord in the household. As yet, the inhabitants of the Hall seem divided. Lady Hathaway has recognized him, and she has the support of one old family retainer, a nanny, who lives in a cottage out on the moor. Her health is poor and her eyesight unreliable, so her opinion carries little weight, but it is something.
He held up two fingers of one hand, then began to count off the fingers opposite.
Then Charles and his wife Mary are on the other side, doubting Jonathan's identity and fearing they are entertaining an impostor.
He spread his hands apart.
That leaves Euphemia in the middle. She has not committed herself either way. She is not certain of what to believe. Was she fond of Jonathan?
Stoker inquired.
It seems curious a younger sister, who might well have idolized her elder brother, would not give full support to someone who could be he.
A faint smile touched Sir Hugo's lips.
Euphemia is a scientist, an astronomer, to be exact. It was Sir Geoffrey's avocation, and she has followed in her grandfather's footsteps. She prefers to deal in facts, in that which may be quantified. She would believe nothing unless there is evidence.
What sort of evidence? I put in. Do you mean to say this person has none of Jonathan Hathaway's papers?
He has documentation, letters and a passport, which appears to be in order, but these things can certainly be falsified.
What does he say about his claim? I pressed.
That is the most intriguing part,
Sir Hugo told us.
He says nothing at all. He appeared one day at Hathaway Hall, bruised and in a state of collapse. On the directions of Mrs. Hathaway, Charles's wife, the stranger was carried into the hall as an act of Christian charity. They bathed his wounds and put him to bed. In the hopes of identifying this stranger, and perhaps notifying his family of his whereabouts, Mrs. Hathaway had his pockets searched and examined the papers that were found upon him. He had letters from Ada, much worn and tattered, addressed to Jonathan Hathaway in care of various post-restaurants around the world. When Lady Hathaway discovered this, she insisted upon seeing the young man herself. She forced her way into the sick room just as the fellow was regaining consciousness. He opened his eyes, said one word, and lapsed into insensibility again.
What word?
Stoker asked.
Grana,
Sir Hugo said.
It was an endearment all of the Hathaway children used for Lady Hathaway. That, coupled with a resemblance to Jonathan, was enough to persuade her that the man lying in the bed was her grandson, returned from the dead.
I shook my head. It is too fantastical to be believed. Sir Hugo's expression was sympathetic.
I know it must have come as a shock to you that someone purporting to be your friend should appear.
How did you know he was my friend? I demanded.
My dear Miss Speedwell, I do hope you have not forgot what resources I have at my command.
He said blandly. You investigated Jonathan Hathaway, I surmised, and you discovered we travelled together.
I was hoping to avoid involving you,
he assured me.
I have dealt with one or two such cases in the past, and I understand how difficult they can be. But I must have the truth, for Effie's sake, for Ada's, even for Jonathan's. If this man is an impostor, then he must be made to pay for his crimes. If it is Jonathan, then all shadow of suspicion must be lifted so that he can live his life in peace.
And you expect Veronica to do that?
Stoker said, folding his arms over his chest. Of course he does, I answered with a tinge of bitterness. I am to be the test.
You knew him?
Sir Hugo said simply.
You travelled with him and were friends. Believe me, if I could have unearthed any other of his companions, I would have done so. I have investigated a dozen people known to have accompanied Jonathan Hathaway in his travels, and it came down to you and a fellow called Harry Spenlove.
I said nothing, but my breath was tight in my chest. Jonathan Hathaway, Harry Spenlove. Names I had not thought to hear again. They had been the best of friends, generous to me when our paths had crossed in New Guinea. Jonathan had had a passion for lepidoptery to rival my own, and Harry was simply game, always up for an adventure. What had begun as a lark, sailing to a new island on the hunt for Papilio Iswaroides, had become a sort of good-natured rivalry. Jonathan and I would challenge one another, choosing a species and separating, meeting again at dinner to see whose hunt had been the more successful. Jonathan played a gentleman's game. He was heir to a fortune and had no need of the money our trophies would fetch from eager collectors. More often than not, his specimens found their way into my jars as he pleaded laziness.
I cannot be bothered to mount them properly, he protested.
Or he claimed to have mislaid his chemicals, misplaced his materials. Any excuse to pass his superfluous specimens my way. He was not entirely altruistic, I remembered with a sharp pang. He often kept the most beautiful, the most unusual, for his own collection. But he had given me more than enough to earn my forgiveness. Coupled with his generosity, he had been a quiet, courtly companion. There was a serenity about him that belied the restless spirit that had sent him around the world, far from kith and kin. Unlike Harry, bright and reckless Harry, Jonathan had been restful. If Harry was a spark, Jonathan was a steady ember. I had adored them both in very different ways and for very different reasons. "You have not discovered Harry Spenlove is alive, I presume?" I said, attempting a lightness I did not feel. Sir Hugo shook his head.
"Buried on the island of Java. I have telegraphed to the Dutch officials there and it has been confirmed. They have sent a rubbing of his gravestone, although one would prefer a photograph. Apparently he died of a fever. Sanitation issues,"
he finished, with a distasteful twitch of the nose. "There was much illness after the eruption," I said dully. "I had not imagined that Jonathan survived."
"Krakatoa erupted 6 years ago,"
Stoker remarked.
"Where has he been all this time?"
Sir Hugo pursed his lips.
"Effie was not particularly forthcoming on that point. I gather the fellow was badly knocked about in the eruption, suffered some injuries, worked his way across South America, that sort of thing. In due course, he made it to Bristol, where he was apparently involved in some sort of altercation with a few sailors. He took the worst of it, and it seems to have aggravated his old injuries. He was in a state of confusion as he made his way to Dartmoor, using the last of his funds to pay his train fare. He alighted at the small moorland village of Shepton Parva. There is a goodish road, but the most direct route is across the moor. He was found in the summer house of the hall. It marks the boundary of the garden from the moor itself. In fact, the summer house is the only way into the grounds of the estate from the moor. The rest is walled off for gardens and inaccessible by foot. He had collapsed by then, in a pitiable state, Effie says. No doubt that is what roused Mrs. Hathaway's pity, although I wonder if she regrets her impulse to take him in."
He finished ruefully.
"If he is indeed Jonathan, he could well wrench her husband's inheritance away,"
Stoker mused,
"to say nothing of her children's. And yet he makes no claim as yet,"
Sir Hugo said with a shrug.
"He has apparently never told anyone to call him Jonathan Hathaway, and answers to the name solely because it pleases Lady Hathaway."
"That is how things stand at present?" I asked.
"It is,"
Sir Hugo confirmed. "And you want me to unmask him for you?" I said.
"Or confirm his identity,"
Sir Hugo answered.
"And if it is Jonathan, believe me, I shall join the Hathaways in killing the fatted calf. But such uncertainty cannot be endured. Miss Speedwell, you cannot refuse me."
Still, I hesitated. "Tell me more about your goddaughter," I said. He paused, pursing his lips.
"She is a curious girl, very curious, a first-rate mind, in the mould of her grandfather, Sir Geoffrey. They are a curious family, most with a few abiding passions and the rare genius. Geoffrey was a genius. Unfortunately, his intellect seems to have passed by the next two generations entirely, save for Euphemia,"
he added dryly.
"She showed real promise as an astronomer, but without her grandfather's guidance, she has drifted. She mourned him, far more than her parents or brother. I sent her a small dog, hoping to cheer her up,"
he added, with a slightly abashed look. "Why gentlemen so often feel the need to conceal their kinder impulses is a mystery only nature herself could answer." "That was thoughtful of you," I told him. He pinked with pleasure.
"It is only a little thing, an Italian greyhound. She dotes on the pup, dresses her in little jumpers, as the moorland climate is too cold for her. I thought having something to care for might bring her out of herself. But there is a quality about her letters, an elusiveness I cannot reconcile with the lively child I once knew."
"Have you visited?"
Stoker asked. Sir Hugo looked uncomfortable.
"I could not attend Sir Geoffrey's funeral. there was a police matter which demanded my presence in London. By the time I was able to get away, some weeks had passed. I knew Effie was still quite melancholy, so I brought the pup with me. I thought to cheer her by taking her for walks and bringing books and paints. She showed no interest in anything other than the dog, and that only when she could spare time from dancing attendance on her sister-in-law.
Mary Hathaway? I inquired. Charles's wife?
The same,
he acknowledged, in a dry tone that confirmed there was no love lost in that quarter.
I do not mind telling you I am no admirer of Mary Hathaway. She is too clever for Charles by half.
How so?
Stoker asked.
She is ambitious, he said, his mouth thinning in distaste. Her father was in trade in Yorkshire, made his fortune in sweets, Fanthorpe's fancies.
Stoker brightened.
I love those, particularly the coconut drops. Yes, well, mind you don't mention that to Mary Hathaway. She is eager to put the origins of her father's money entirely behind her. She aspired to an old name, and in marrying Charles, she succeeded. There's little of the Hathaway money left, but that does not seem to trouble her. She has plenty from her father, and she means to polish Charles up and make something of him.
And how does Charles feel about that? I inquired. Sir Hugo pulled a face.
The boy likes sheep. All he wants is to restore the family flocks. They used to be legendary, the Hathaway Morelands. But that is not grand enough for Mary. She expects him to stand for Parliament with an eye to a knighthood some day, and preferably a baronetcy.
Lofty goals,
Stoker remarked.
Not if you have the brass, and Mary Hathaway does. Before she and Charles took charge of the hall, it was a very quiet household. But since they settled, Mary has been making over the house and wants to try her hand at Effie as well. She uses the girl, morning to night, always asking her to fetch and do.
Perhaps she likes lording her status over Effie, I suggested. She wouldn't be the first sister-in-law to do so.
Or she is simply trying to keep Effie too busy to bother with astronomy,
Sir Hugo said.
Mary has convinced Charles that such studies are not genteel enough, and that Effie has been indulged far too much.
And Charles goes along with it?
Stoker asked.
Charles would agree if Mary told him the moon was made of milk.
Sir Hugo replied sourly.
He is well and truly henpecked. When I was at the hall, I am afraid I let my temper get the better of me. I accosted Charles and told him it was appalling that he permitted his wife to use his sister in such a fashion and that Effie ought to be allowed to continue her studies. Cross words, I am sorry to say, were exchanged. I have not returned since, and I have been informed that any spontaneous visit on my part would not be encouraged. Effie has no money of her own.
He finished.
Without funds, she cannot leave. So she remains there, a sort of drudge to her brother's wife.
Poor girl,
Stoker said with real sympathy. I repressed a sigh. She lacks gumption. Sir Hugo's brows raised perceptibly.
How can you claim to know that?
She is in good health, is she not?
She is.
And you have said she has had a good education. She comes from a good family. She might strike out on her own. She might teach or hire herself as a companion, where at least she would earn a wage for her efforts. Instead, she does not bestir herself. She is content to exist in a sort of larval stage. She must be prodded out of her inactivity, I added firmly. I was a fervent believer in the restorative benefits of action.
The girl has been grieving,
Stoker reminded me. For more than a year, and that is quite enough time to mourn anyone, I told him. I think we should undertake this mission to liberate Euphemia Hathaway from her torpid state.
I have a walrus, an enormous walrus. to say nothing of my albino giraffe,"
Stoker said. His jaw was set in a line I recognized only too well. He was feeling decidedly mulish. He was longing to return to his workshop and immerse himself in his beloved trophies. We had only just returned from one of our little adventures, and I realized with a pang how often he had given way to my intrepid derailments of his plans. "Sir Hugo, this is not the best time," I said, prepared for once to make the sacrifice Stoker so clearly wanted of me. Sir Hugo turned to Stoker.
"Since you cannot present yourself at Hathaway Hall as agents of mine, I thought you could go under false pretenses. At least, not entirely false. You see, the original Tudor house was pulled down in the time of the Jacobeans. The building that took its place is dark and halfway to falling down of its own accord. The decades the family spent in India meant it was neglected, and Sir Geoffrey preferred to spend the funds on his observatory instead of mundane things like the roof. Charles has inherited a bit of a white elephant, and Mary has grand plans for the place. She wants it fully modernized, tiled bathrooms in the bedroom wings, flushing, appurtenances," he said, colouring a rosy shade at the idea of such indelicate matters as toilets. "Fresh wallpaper, furniture, all modern and comfortable. What she does not want is what she refers to as all the dusty rubbish the Hathaways brought back from their travels. Charles and Effie's father was a natural historian, not a particularly gifted one, but competent. He assembled a comprehensive set of mounts in his travels. As it happens, those mounts are still at Hathaway Hall, and I know that Mary Hathaway would be perfectly delighted to present his collection to Lord Rosmoren for his proposed museum."
He let the suggestion hang there, enticing as a juicy morsel of bait to a rising carp.
"I have specimens,"
Stoker told him.
"More than I know what to do with, I promise you."
Sir Hugo smiled.
"Oh, have you a thylacine, then?"
Stoker stopped dead in his tracks.
"You cannot be serious. As the grave,"
Sir Hugo assured him.
"Thylacinus cynocephalus,"
Stoker breathed, his eyes alight with the sort of unholy lust other men reserved for women. "The Tasmanian tiger?" I asked. "I thought they were near to extinction."
"They are,"
Stoker said, his colour high.
"It is the largest carnivorous marsupial in the world. The power of its bite and the dimension of its jaw..."
I need not repeat the rest. He went on in that vein for some time, to Sir Hugo's obvious amusement. At length, I raised a hand to quell any further information about the creature, still grappling with Stoker's overly detailed explanation of the uniqueness of the scrotal sac in the male of the species. "You are clearly in a state of desperation, else you'd not have cast such a tempting lure," I told Sir Hugo.
"I am,"
he said. In spite of the words, his expression was not quite pleading, imploring. He wanted a favour, I reminded myself, and although justice would have been enough to spur me to action, the thought of Sir Hugo in my debt was a powerful inducement.
"Miss Speedwell,"
Sir Hugo said,
"you cannot refuse me."
"You are right," I said, setting a mirthless smile upon my lips. "I cannot. When do we leave?"